weekly update schedule. We will not have a weekly update next week. We will return 2 weeks from today. And, of course, today we have a weekly update. Malcolm Hoenlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, joins us for the weekly update here at JM in the AM. Mr. Hoenlein, welcome back to the show.
Oh, good morning to you.
Sounds like it's been a rough week.
Oh, it's always interesting.
Whoever thought...
As the Chinese curse goes.
What is it?
As the Chinese curse goes, may you live in interesting times, being overdone.
Yeah, boy, that's for sure. Someone must have doubled or tripled that curse. Whoever thought that at the beginning of the month of July, at a time when so many Americans are off from work, to the point where I noticed it this morning coming in, how many fewer cars were on the road. And yet, there is so much to discuss. Tell me about this letter in the Wall Street Journal regarding Jonathan Pollard.
The letter from Jim Woolsey?
Yeah.
Jim Woolsey, you know, was a former head of the CIA. And when he was in that position, told me, in fact, in the day that he was being sworn in, he called me into his office alone, and he was a great friend of Israel, and is today a truly great friend of Israel. But he was adamant about the issue of Pollard not being released, ever, perhaps. And he says now the difference is time. He said, it's now 27 years. It's time to let him go. And this is one of those who was directly involved, so he has to have been, I know that he was, he had access to the information and what the charges were. He was head of Naval Intelligence, I think, during the time that the incident took place, and if you remember, that's where Pollard was assigned. So it is significant, and it's evoked some negative responses, but he has held his ground. And he's a very courageous leader in any event, and has been very outspoken in his friendship for Israel and the Jewish community for many years.
I know you would say every little bit helps, but practically speaking, is this going to make a difference?
Well, I think, you know, it's like it has the erosionary impact of water on Iraq that eventually you wear away some of the opposition. And when somebody with his credibility and his former titles and he comes and his former position, and he comes out in favor of it, I do think that it has an impact. Like George Shultz and like Lawrence Korb, who were opposed to it in the past, have all now signed on to petitions and public statements calling for Pollard's release.
Yeah, it is an impressive list of people who in the past were so adamant against Pollard and have turned things around.
That's true, and it's due to the credit of a number of people, David Nye or others, who have worked so hard, people really devoted to the issue, and we've all tried to help line up many of those who have signed on, and many of whom were initially very skeptical about doing so. But I do see that there is a growing acceptance in a broader and broader range of people, people of influence and significance, who have now signed on.
Including the president of Israel, who probably would not have been as enthusiastic about it years back.
That's true.
Yeah. Speaking of leadership in Israel, we lost Yitzhak Shamir this week. I had to be reminded that he was the second longest serving prime minister. Sometimes you don't realize what's going on in terms of history as things are happening. And a lot of very interesting coverage of his death by the Israeli press. I think some strange rewriting of history in certain aspects. But anyway, when you look back at Shamir's term in office and this time he spent as Prime Minister of Israel, what mostly do you associate with him?
Well, I was very close to him, as you know, and I was one of the few people who could understand when he spoke English. He had a tendency to be very quiet. I remember once David Bar-Ilan wrote a speech for him, the famous pianist who moved back to Israel and became official in the government, writing and advising on public relations, and he was a genius in many respects. But he once wrote a speech about the prime minister, where he was supposed to say, we vow, and it came out, be wow. So his English wasn't always clear, but his intent was always clear. And this is a guy who never wavered. He didn't give in to political expediency. He stuck by his principles. I can tell you, I once went to see him about getting the debt forgiveness from the United States when it was offered to him at the time of the Gulf War. If you remember, Egypt got, I don't know, $7 billion in debt forgiveness.
Right.
Jordan got, and they offered it to Israel. And he adamantly refused. I remember going there just over a weekend. I was there for 30 hours, maybe. And we got into a very heated exchange over it. And he kept saying, because he was told that it would hurt Israel's credit rating, which I didn't understand, but when he had a position that he felt was a principled position, he would stick to it no matter what. And you saw it in the way he conducted himself. And people, you know, he is the most unlikely prime minister, I guess you could say.
Mm-hmm.
He was not somebody who was yearning to be prime minister. It was the accidental prime minister. He came into it when Begin suddenly resigned, and the same thing, he came into the foreign ministry because of a shift that took place. He was not somebody who wanted to operate in the limelight. He was never even comfortable in it. He would enjoy, you know, even when he was here, sitting in the room, have us come up, talk to us about all the things that were going on, but he was very shy and reticent about some of the more public events.
The only time that I remember ever being yelled at on this show by a former prime minister was when he yelled at me for suggesting to him in an interview that he began the Oslo process by going to Madrid in 1988. Was I right or wrong?
No. He went with a different intent in going there. Some will say he legitimized the process. But he knew that, and he was under tremendous pressure from the United States, from others, to be there. He knew the consequences of not going would have been great, and therefore went, but never, as he said later, with the intent of initiating the process that evolved.
But sometimes, as we know historically, I know it's easy to be a Monday morning quarterback, but as we know historically, sometimes small gestures, even those made with other intentions, do lead to circumstances that even the person himself is against.
Sure. Happens many times. Or people can't anticipate or don't know how the course of history tends to sometimes meander in ways that are not predictable.
So it's not a stretch to say that the sequence of events that took place over those 5 years were led by him.
It's a stretch.
It is?
No. I think in retrospect, he did address this several times. But if you know what's interesting, there's no memorial, there's no museum like there is for all of the other former prime ministers. I don't know if there is some rule that it has to be after their passing, but you notice that he went right into a sort of quiet retirement. He had an office. I went to visit him there many times after he left the prime ministership. And he would sit there until 1 o'clock. He would leave for lunch, no matter what, go home and have lunch. He did the same, by the way, as prime minister many times. He would talk to us openly about many of those issues. So it's, you know what, it's very easy to second guess with hindsight.
Yeah, I understand. Okay, I got you. News from Jerusalem this week. So, has the Plessner Committee been disbanded, and is Kadima threatening to now leave this blissful coalition that we lauded so much last month over this whole issue of the army service?
Well, the prime minister essentially disbanded or said, but the Plessner himself has not, and I think Deputy Prime Minister Shaul Mofaz, the head of Kadima, who has threatened to pull out, has now given more time to Netanyahu. I think that they will try to work to come up with some sort of understanding, something that will bridge the gap. I think the Prime Minister felt the obligation to try and do that. He did not want to see the individual fines on Haredi or others who do not serve. What is interesting is that the number of Haredim signing up for military service has shot up in recent weeks in the wake of the Plesner report, and we will have to yet see what the outcome will be in this regard.
What do you think that's due to?
The uncertainty about what will happen with the draft, and that they want to get into the special units, the Nahal Haredi and other kinds of units. And the truth is that there are many who do want to go in if there was a feasible way for them to do it, because it's key to jobs, it's key to their own futures. Many of them who are not learning full-time would welcome the ability to go and work. But part of the problem is also that you can't have them go to work where they will always have the bottom-rung jobs. There are amazing institutions graduating hundreds and hundreds of Haredim in law and accounting and other things that get very little notice. So many people like to paint everybody with one brush and to try and portray the entire community as non-participatory. The fact is that the Haredi units have been extremely successful, and there's talk of setting up three more bases for them. The Army has to have the infrastructure to accommodate the needs of the Orthodox soldiers who come in, and just as they would accommodate any other soldiers' needs, reasonable needs. These are not unreasonable demands that are being made, and I really believe it's essential not to allow the Israeli society, especially at this time, to be rent apart over this issue.
Is it possible, now back to the whole Knesset strategy here, is it possible to not be rent apart? Even if there's because it seems like even if there's a small compromise, even if there's a small movement in or a small shift in the policy that exists right now, it seems like it seems like the side of the ultra Orthodox is so strong and so steadfast in their approach to this that it will cause a rift, it will cause a split, that there's no room for compromise on that side.
Well, I do believe that there is some room. I do believe that it won't encompass everybody, but the Army can't take everybody anyway. The question is there an equal assumption of responsibility? Do we show that people who are legitimately learning should be learning, and that the rest and others should be contributing? And there are alternative ways. There's national service. There are ways that they could do it by teaching, by going into communities around Israel, by making a difference in a positive way, and still they could continue learning and doing other things, but fulfill their obligation to the state. And I think that there is a much broader consensus, and I've spoken to some of the key rabbinic leaders in Israel about it, and they are very sensitive to it. They would like to see a way to address this, while not impinging on the right of people to learn and understanding its importance, and at the same time helping those who cannot, because the economic burdens and the economic dislocation in many of these communities is a tremendous burden on the leadership who recognize it, but know that for the long term the situation can continue as it is.
You know, there's certain rabbinic leaders who have come out in favor of Nahal HaRedi and suffer because of it.
That's true, and they should be supported and recognized for it. The problem is that those who support these things don't hear, and you have extremists in every camp in the Knesset, some of the Knesset parties and others who really want to have this as a showdown issue for their own political purposes, some because they honestly believe the point but don't want to see and don't believe in a compromise, others who harbor whatever feelings they do, and of course you see extremists in the Haredi world too that exacerbate the problems by their actions and some of the responsible actions, which are denounced and not accepted by the leadership. And again, as I said, I've spoken to some of them about it, and you know, they have to live in the real world. They have obligations. They have communities that they're responsible for. So it's not as if they're indifferent. The question is how you can work it out in a way that can accommodate all the needs. And the Army, as I said, probably can't accept everybody anyway.
Right.
It's a question of principle here.
Is it possible that some of the Kadima members and other members of Knesset are strategizing and saying, you know what, we're going to throw all these possibilities out there and really anger the other side in terms of the type of army service that we're demanding that they do. And then we'll extend the plane of compromise, and we'll have an opportunity. Once we extend, we'll have an opportunity to sit down and come up with some type of agreement.
That's possible. If they think through it through that far, I don't know. But I don't believe that Kadima leaders want to go to an election now. They know that their chances in election would be very limited. It's the reason why they joined the government. So for political, purely political reasons, I don't know that this is the time for them to put down ultimatums and really go all the way with it.
Right. So even though you don't predict, if someone asked you today if you think this coalition is going to remain for a few months, you would probably say yes.
I would think that it's not in anyone's interest to break it up. One or two parties can leave. The religious parties have threatened to leave. Kadima has threatened to leave. Maybe Netanyahu should have gone to elections. He may regret having this broad coalition, which in the first blush was seen as so positive. But you see right away this is the first test and the critical test that they knew would come.
Right. Tomorrow night's rally in Israel is a rally demanding that everybody serve in the army, correct?
To universalize service, right.
And anything, I mean, do we expect a massive crowd? Is it going to become I know it's a national issue already, but it's going to, you know, there's some national issues really take on tremendous passion when people hit the streets. Is it going to become like that or not?
It gets caught up in the whole social protest movements, which have been spreading again and reactivated during the summer months. And I think it all gets put into the same chilling pot of issues. But certainly, it already is an issue that I know a few issues in Israel that arouse more passion than this.
Right, but could there be, what I'm asking is, could there be 100,000 people there tomorrow night? I mean, is it possible that it could
I
be?
Yes, it depends on the weather, but yes,
but it could be a massive crowd. Right? America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program, heard on listeners-sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, around the world on the web, jmnam.org. Malcolm Honlein is with us. We will not have our weekly update next week, but we will return 2 weeks from today. This you mentioned over the last couple of weeks about this UNESCO heritage listing, and it finally made the New York Times. I assume you saw it. I think it was last Friday. And I was surprised, frankly, at their approach. I thought they were more understanding to the Israeli side than I would have expected them to be. But the reality is now that there's been a Palestinian request for special status for the church in Bethlehem, and the Israeli officials are denouncing it as Israel bashing. Is this and there was an official vote, right? A UNESCO vote on this?
UNESCO approved it. And this despite the fact that their own team of experts rejected the claim, said that there was no emergency and no rapid deterioration as Palestinians had claimed. This is another one of the staged actions by the PA. This is what they've been doing all along. I've tried to talk about what the significance is because people don't necessarily on the surface see why is this, you know, a relevant issue. Who cares what the UN declares? And the fact is that this is an attempt again to attack Israel's sovereignty, again to assert, to bypass negotiations, to keep the pressure on Israel, to use their membership in UNESCO to challenge Israel. And the significance is obvious, and I think, you know, the UNESCO vote was ridiculous. The United States and Israel both voted against it. We also have a standoff at an arms control talks where the Palestinians are demanding recognition as a state participant, and Israel is opposing it, and you need a unanimous vote in order to pass it. And with Israel saying that they will block it, the whole agreement, if the Palestinians, the United States also has tried to get them to back off. But this is part of the game they're playing. They're playing it on every front. They're using delegitimization. They're using the UN. They go to great lengths. And at the time, it is to avoid negotiations. You see, Abbas is about to meet with Hillary Clinton again at a time when the PA's finances are in collapse. He's not focusing on that. They are unable to pay salaries. They claim this is the usual ploy that when they have facing all these internal difficulties, he strikes out against Israel using any external mechanism that he can to avoid negotiations and try to build in the meantime the pressure on Israel.
Yeah, I'll go back to the PA finances in a second, but I'm trying to understand what are the practical implications of this whole UNESCO thing. In other words, their real goal would be on the ground. The real goal would be to get the church out of Israeli hands, right? It would the authority of it would be transferred over to the PA, I would guess,
and it's not going to stop there. I mean, they're going to do the same thing with Har HaBayit. They're going to do it with every other location. But also, the Christian groups have opposed it because they remember what happened when the Palestinians took over the church in Nativity. I was there in Bethlehem. I saw it. I saw the terrorists marching back and forth near a window. In using the nuns' habits and some of the monks' habits, clothing, and you could see a gun sticking out from the back, and this was if you remember a long siege that and Israel, out of respect for the sanctity of the building, trying to keep from having to destroy it, didn't rush the building and kill all these terrorists, but the so the Christian groups were not in favor of this, but it's part of the delegitimization campaign. It's part of, you know, using the fact that they got into UNESCO, hurt UNESCO greatly because of the funding and other ramifications, but they use any platform, which is why people may think it's irrelevant when we fight on some of these issues, but you got to look at it longer term,
right?
And events like this prove it.
Yeah. Any shockers of the 13 who voted for it or the 6 who were against? Any unexpected on either side?
France's role in it was very disappointing.
Oh, wow. I didn't see a list of the different countries. Now, in terms of the PA finances, Israel itself, the prime minister has requested that the IMF actually give $1 billion to the PA. Why would Israel be out there doing the bidding of the PA?
Because the collapse of the PA right now would add the burden to Israel. It would it would create circumstances there that would be just feed the radicalization, further radicalization. And this is being done with Fayyad, not with Abbas, in an attempt. It was a loan to the Palestinian Authority. It's not money.
They're not giving it to them.
Back the request together with Fayyad, Stanley Fisher, the head of the governor of the Bank of Israel, for a loan to the Palestinians. The real reason for the problem is, as always, that the Israelis pay, the United States pays, but the Arab countries are not paying any of their pledges to these guys. And instead, the PA is so busy focusing on whether Arafat, trying to resurrect Arafat, and, you know, talking about exhuming him and claiming that he was poisoned with plutonium or something, I mean, just ridiculous charges. If you remember, he died in a French hospital. The French doctors have all the records. Why don't they just release the records? It was the Palestinians who forced them to seal it and not reveal the cause of death, which Ahmed Jibril even and others said was AIDS, and other people said other things, blood disease. But now this idea, which implicitly accuses Israel of poisoning him with some sort of radioactive material, you know, it's another one of these diversionary things, which people again dismiss. But you have to realize there are going to be tens and not hundreds of millions of people who will believe it, who believe that this story is true. Why don't they just get the French doctors to release it?
Right.
All of a sudden, his underwear reveals something new.
Why does Iran make public declarations that now their missile tests have confirmed they can reach Israel?
Well, they also said they can reach 35 bases of the United States, and I think this is in part desperation on their part. For a second here, let's look at the condition that Iran finds itself. Its currency is down 50% a year. The estimates are they will export 1.1 million barrels per day now. Last year it was 2.2 million. They lost about $3.5 billion last month in income, and oil is 80% of their foreign revenues. So they are late in paying their soldiers, even though Iran still sells more Porsches than any other country in the Middle East. But that goes to the Iran Revolutionary Guard leaders and others. The people are suffering, and they are looking for these diversions. They, you know, the talks are supposed to resume between the P5 plus one, but at the same time, you see their reaction. Ali Larijani, the Speaker of the Majlis, the Parliament, said it's time that the U.S. and Israel vanish. You see the declaration by the Chief of Staff, as you mentioned, about hitting 35 bases, U.S. bases. I don't know where they got the number, but it's a lot more than what the United States knows. And then the legislature passed a law that they have to block ships going through the Straits of Hormuz if they come from countries honoring the boycott of Iran. So it's a reflection of the worsening economic conditions, the sanctions are taking a heavy bite, and even Ahmadinejad said the new round of sanctions are tough. But they're talking back tough, and they launched that exercise where they launched medium and short-range and long-range missiles of various kinds, which would target both U.S. targets, Europe, and Israel. The United States has, in turn, had a buildup in the Persian Gulf. We doubled the number of minesweepers, I think, to 8. We have the Ponce, which is, I mentioned a couple weeks ago, would be moving there. It's an amphibious transport and docking ship. It's the first floating staging base ever. And the buildup of aircraft going into the Persian Gulf countries, many other things that are taking place. And I told you, always watch the ships, the movement of our aircraft carriers and ships in the Gulf, the Arab or Persian Gulf, right, depending on your preference, which flavor you like, to know what is going to happen.
So, number one, it deserved to be a headline. It's unusual activity.
Yes.
As much as the United States and its allies spend time in that area, this week's activity was unusual. And do the geography for us one more time. This is how close to which countries?
The missile capacity,
yeah,
1,300 miles with the long-range missile, which means that it can hit any target in Israel, can hit Saudi Arabia, can hit... They did this test in Balochistan, but it can hit any part of Europe. Remember, Iran is a big country, and you can move the things around. It's also, I guess, meant to be an answer to the missile defense systems in Turkey.
Al-Qaeda streaming into Syria is something that's against Assad, against Russia, against Iran. Who should be careful now that Al-Qaeda is starting to dominate there?
Well, it's not domination. First of all, you have a lot of groups. Hezbollah is there, Iran is there, and other groups, and especially Al-Qaeda in Iraq, has crossed over. You have a group called Al-Nusra, I think it's called, which is an Al-Qaeda affiliate, which took credit for the attacks around Syria over the last week or so. But their presence, their growing presence, has been known. But you have many groups who have come into Syria. By the way, when you always want some lighter note, Syria is contesting for a seat on the Human Rights Council of the UN now. So I think that if anybody wants to understand the ludicrousness of the UN system, but Assad really had a blow this week with the defection yesterday of a guy named Manar Tlas. You might remember Mustafa Tlas, his father, was the Minister of Defense, very anti-Israel, really viciously outspoken leader who wrote a book, a really anti-Semitic book, when he was Minister of Defense. The son, who was a close friend of Assad's, defected yesterday.
Oh, wow.
And we're seeing more and more defections of key personnel. The Arab states, in the meantime, have been trying to press to get the opposition united, but at the meetings it seems that there's been a lot of contentiousness and squabbling between them. They came up with an 81-page paper, but they're certainly not united. There's a meeting this weekend in Paris, which Hillary Clinton, amongst others, will attend under the auspices of the President of France, where they're trying to get the opposition to unite. The question is, what is going to be the role of the Muslim Brotherhood, and how do you increase the weapons importation to the opposition groups without them ending up in the wrong hands? We know that that even Moscow, we've heard more stringent comments from Moscow and from China, maybe even in terms of some of the sanctions against Syria. They're not talking about removing it. Assad, by the way, said in an interview to a Turkish paper this week that certainly he would step down, or the leader of Syria should step aside in the interest of the country, but that can only be decided inside the country, which, as we know, means that the vote is a very limited one.
Yeah. Any update for us regarding the new leadership in Egypt?
Well, the situation in Egypt, you know, continues to be very interesting, and we watch it very closely because of what Masri will do. He announced, or there was an announcement, that he would go to Iran. We don't know whether this is, again, another one of these false reports. But as you remember, there were the reports, supposedly, of an interview where he said that he would build ties to Tehran, to Iran. Khamenei had actually said that in a speech, and it turns out that this was not true, that he did not say it, and he did not even give the interview. where it was supposed to be. It was quoted, but Tehran keeps talking about upgrading their relationships. The fact that he used his inaugural speech to call for the release of Sheikh Rahman, I think, shook people up because it's a reflection of his priorities. But he has such huge economic problems to confront. We will have to see, where does he put his priorities? Is it to limit the military, to spread the influence of the Muslim Brotherhood, which is ultimately the goal? That's what they were established for, and ultimately it will be his goal. The question is, how much a priority does power moderate his stance, or does it just give him a platform to be more extreme?
Isn't it silly that I keep seeing articles about the potential of him being part of a continued Israeli-Egyptian peace accord?
Well, there are people who say that he's the guy who can make real peace with Israel, that he's the guy who can do it, even though there's no indication right now that that's the case. You know, Secretary Clinton is going to Egypt and to Israel next week. They're trying to reach out to the new president to build ties to him. But we should remember where he comes from, that he was the second candidate. He wasn't the prime candidate, but the runner-up, who got it when the other guy, the other candidate was eliminated. So Masri got the candidacy and won in a squeaker vote. You know that the other countries look at this with great wariness, especially the Gulf countries, who have issued warnings to Iran. The Muslim Brotherhood is banned in the Gulf countries, and they don't like seeing Egypt governed by this, and the fear that it becomes a base for spreading it further in the region. So Masri had better start looking at the economy of the country. He's got to look at solidifying his own hold. I think they will try to look to build a constitution and reconstitute the parliament as a basis for him to cut the power of the military.
Finally, Malcolm, obviously Israeli armed forces, thank God, with God above, have an amazing presence on all the borders, including up north. But we continue to read about Hezbollah expanding its command posts up north, its bases in different villages in southern Lebanon. There's a story that everyone can find on the homepage of the Jerusalem Post this morning. Obviously, what's most concerning is, are we in, God forbid, for a repeat of what we saw up north just a few years back? Is Israel going to do anything in a preemptive fashion as Hezbollah continues to expand above their northern border?
Well, there were a couple stories this week, and I think that the purpose of the declarations is to prevent exactly that scenario, and it's to put Hezbollah on warning and put the Lebanese people and Lebanese government on warning, because unlike last time when Israel was restrained in its ability to strike at different bases in Lebanon because Hezbollah was not part of the government, now Hezbollah is part of the government. It is part of the Lebanese army. They are one, and therefore the limitations would be removed. As one person said, where do you see the Goldstone report on this war if it, God forbid, takes place? So I don't believe that Hezbollah wants a war right now. But what we've seen is this incredible network of tunnels revealed that Iran helped Hezbollah build. There were some of this was uncovered during the last Lebanon war, but now these are much more sophisticated. They have dormitories underground, kitchen facilities. People can live there for weeks to be undetected and be able to maneuver through this network of tunnels in southern Lebanon, which again puts Israel ill at ease. And we know that there has been a tremendous infusion of weapons, and the concern is that Lebanon could be used as a diversion by Iran. It could Hezbollah could feel the need to heat things up. Often during the summer months this happens. I think it's a more of a warning that and the declarations by coming from senior IDF officials about preparing for a Lebanon war is a reflection of the concern about what will happen. And of course the biggest concern in Syria is the huge stockpiles of chemical and biological weapons as well, which are under the control of the Syrian intelligence now. But in a collapse, I can say this is a number one priority for Israel, for U.S., for others, and steps have been taken to try and be ready for that and not let happen what happened in Libya, where by the time the Western forces were in to try and contain it, the weapons were all over, causing problems in Mali and other countries in Africa, let alone in Gaza and Sinai. So the the fear about these weapons and an escalation in Lebanon, because Iran's hold on Hezbollah is much stronger than on Hamas, and Hamas split over the Syria business. So the concern is that they would somehow instigate some problems on the Lebanese border, something Israel certainly doesn't want to see.
Right.
There is one other thing, and I think people should be concerned, and that's about the European anti-Semitism. You had a young Avrecha, a young guy beaten up in London. We had, again, incidents on a train where a Rav was beaten up in Paris on a train that left Toulouse, of all places. The number of incidents that we are seeing in Europe, again, we've tried to discuss this for many years, warning people about the changing situation there. People don't want to see it. They don't want to hear it. I know it makes them uncomfortable when we discuss it. It's not because it's bad news, because it's real news, and that's what people have to understand. You have to watch the situation, and you see that the leadership there are taking more and more serious steps, and it's not unrelated to what happens in the Middle East. It's not unrelated to the spread of Islamist ideology. It is not solely tied to that, and not all the people involved are Muslims.
Right.
But you saw a group of six people that were arrested in London yesterday for Muslims involved in a potential terrorist attack. We see it in other countries. People have to be alert to it. It's why we urge people here, every institution, every camp during the summer, and every school during the year, and every synagogue, to take steps to improve security. It's our obligation. It's a responsibility. You see these incidents, don't dismiss them.
Yep, no question about it. All right, Malcolm, we reconvene 2 weeks from today. Have a wonderful Shabbos, and we'll speak again soon. Weekly update returns 2 weeks from today here at JM in the AM.